You've most likely seen the news. Last Wednesday, an attacker shot and killed 18 people and wounded 13 others at a bowling alley and bar in Lewiston, Maine. On Friday, after a two-day manhunt, the suspect was found dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His motives for the shooting aren't entirely clear at this point. Law enforcement is still completing an investigation. Authorities say, though, that it was likely linked to paranoia. The assailant was committed to a mental health facility after making threats of violence during an Army Reserve training exercise near West Point, New York, back in July. A statewide awareness alert was sent out in September after he made more threats against his base and fellow soldiers. Law enforcement visited his home for a welfare check but never located him. Since these details have emerged, a lot of focus has been placed on his mental health history. But our next guest says it's important not to stigmatize mental health issues in the aftermath of mass violence. Here's Maine's Department of Public Safety Commissioner Michael Soschuk speaking at a press conference at Lewiston City Hall on Saturday.
Something that's incredibly important for us to say and for me to say, and I find myself saying it on a regular basis, just because there's appears to be a mental health nexus to this scenario, the vast majority of people, with a mental health diagnosis will never hurt anybody.
Our next guest is a psychiatrist who helps patients with serious mental illness. She's been at the forefront of educating healthcare providers on how to prevent firearm violence because she says gun violence is more than a political problem in this country. It's also a public health crisis. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of when you see a focus on mental health when we talk about mass shootings and other forms of gun violence? Are there changes in laws you'd like to see? Red flag laws, for example. Do you have questions about where mental illness and firearm access run into each other? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Barnhorst is an inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, the vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, and associate director of the California Firearms Violence Research Center. She's also the director of the Bullet Points Project, a state-funded effort to develop a firearm violence prevention curriculum for healthcare providers. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
As an expert in firearm law and mental illness, what's been going through your mind as you watch and read media coverage of the tragic shootings in Lewiston?
It's so horrible to see this happen yet again. And it's not surprising that, of course, the mental illness angle has been brought up, as it often is. In the case of this man, it does seem like he was experiencing some symptoms, possibly of a serious mental illness, some paranoia, maybe hearing voices. And in addition to that, he had been hospitalized, it seems like, for some time this summer. And so there's all these questions, as there often are, like, how could a guy like this, who clearly had some mental health problems and had been making threats, how was he able to legally own a bunch of guns? And this is something that comes up over and over again. And I think it really gets to this idea of, what are we want to do preventatively in the future? And are we going to target his firearm access? Are we going to target the mental health system? And where do we put the onus on making some changes so that this doesn't keep happening?
As we heard from the Maine Department of Public Safety there, the overwhelming majority of people with diagnosable mental health conditions will not commit an act of violence. And correct me if I'm wrong, many people who commit acts of violence don't have a diagnosable mental health connection. It's not so easy as to say we could solve gun violence by targeting mental health. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a psychiatrist who works in a very a system with very scarce resources, I would be a traitor to my people to say, oh, we don't need any more bolstering of the mental health system. We absolutely do. We should be putting a lot of money into getting more facilities stood up, more systems resources for people, more psychiatrists, more social workers, more therapists. I mean, the mental health system needs a lot of support in shoring up. However, I don't think that is an effective way to prevent violence, the preponderance of which in the United States is community violence that happens in the context of, you know, domestic violence, neighborhoods that have high levels of poverty, people of color in the context of crimes. It's not mostly mass shootings, even though that's often what many Americans worry about happening to them. Most people who have a serious mental illness are just trying to get by and get to their appointments and keep their housing and get their medications refilled. They're not perpetrating these acts of violence. And like you mentioned, the majority of people who perpetrate these acts of violence don't have a diagnosable or treatable mental illness. But occasionally there is some overlap there. And then, you know, folks often do associate mental illness with mass shootings.
Now, in states around the country, we've seen different versions of what people call red flag laws. The idea that under certain circumstances, under certain procedures, and it varies from place to place, we can remove guns from the hands of the possession of people who were worried about committing an act of violence. Can you talk about some broad strokes, what these laws are and what they try to do?
Yeah, I helped actually work on the development of the law here in California, which we passed in 2014 in the wake of the Isla Vista shooting. And in the subsequent, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's been a number of other ones passed, mostly in the wake of mass shootings, because what was repeatedly happening was somebody who had firearms, often owned them legally or purchased them legally, got on the radar of the police for making threats, behaving erratically, doing things that people perceived as potentially very dangerous, including things like uploading videos, essentially saying on YouTube that they were going to perpetrate some sort of act of mass violence. The problem is, if the person hasn't committed a crime and they're not really clearly meeting the relatively stringent criteria to be involuntarily psychiatrically hospitalized, there's not much police can do. And in Isla Vista here in California, what we saw was that the police went to this guy's house and talked to him because his parents were concerned, other people were concerned about him. And he presented as very well put together. He said, "Oh, I've been having a hard time, but everything's fine." There was no evidence that any crime had been committed. He didn't appear to be mentally ill. He didn't have a mental health history that would have justified some sort of hospitalization. And so the police had no recourse. There was really nothing they could do. This also happened with Parkland, that that guy was on their radar and they knew about him. People were afraid of him, but he wasn't somebody who was arrestable. He wasn't somebody who was committable to a psychiatric hospital. And so we kind of fell through this gap between the mental health system and the criminal justice system. And that's where these red flag laws come in, is that they allow police or family members, in some states, other people as well, to petition to have somebody's guns removed, not because they've committed a crime or not because they appear to be mentally ill, but because they appear to be dangerous. And it really stands on that. And they can work very quickly. So you don't have to wait for a mental health professional to do a long evaluation and diagnose the person and get them into a hospital. Police oftentimes can get an order from a judge over the phone and get the guns out of a threatening situation, or other people can petition for an order with the court and it can be approved and served within, you know, hours or days.
Then, and I think this is something that concerns people who advocate for the Second Amendment and gun rights. As I understand it, there's usually a procedure. If my guns, say, have been taken under these circumstances, there are ways for me to petition to say, no, I am perfectly capable of handling them. What would be the next step in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. A really good point. So it's not like, you know, anyone can just take your guns away for any reason that they feel a little unease. There is a legal process. Due process is in place. So the respondent to the order within 2 weeks will go to court. They will give the judge their side of the story and say like, oh, you know, hey, I was having a bad time, or I made those statements, but I didn't mean them. And the judge gets a chance to hear the evidence from both sides and then can potentially return the person's firearms if they don't believe that the person continues to be a threat. And here in California, the research that's been done at the center where I work has shown that a lot of these orders, there was an emergency order issued, but then the final order that would happen after that hearing where the respondent got a chance to plead their case, the firearms were returned and the order was lifted. So either, you know, the crisis period had passed in the 2 weeks, or the person wasn't quite as dangerous or threatening as they initially presented. So they don't always go to a longer term order. And even the longer term orders can last months, sometimes up to years with renewals. But it's a civil order. It's not something on your criminal record. It doesn't involve a psychiatric hospitalization. So in some ways it does, with due process in place, it does target people's Second Amendment rights. But one of the things I like about it is that it only targets those rights and it only targets them temporarily. It doesn't, you know, go on your criminal record. Again, it doesn't involuntarily put you in a hospital and take you out of your home and your community and your job and your social support. It just removes the firearms from a crisis situation with the option of you getting them back.
We're talking to Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the University of California Davis Department of Psychiatry, director of the Bullet Points Project. We're talking about the overlap, the intersection of mental health and firearm violence prevention, as well as red flag and other laws after last week's mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you think states like Wisconsin should have red flag laws in place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Amy Barnhorst, expert on firearms law and mental illness, who helped develop California's red flag law and has testified before state legislatures on these issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we could talk about mental health concerns and guns and firearm violence without going into harmful stereotypes or stigmas? Are you a healthcare provider who works with patients who have mental illness? And do you have questions for our guest about her work, helping clinicians understand firearm violence prevention? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I'm just, I would say it should be a federally passed law. A red flag law would be awesome for the nation. If someone has the means to carry out their threats and they make the threats and friends and family, neighbors, community realize that this person has made these threats and yet they have the means to carry them out, whether they purchase the guns legally or illegally, they should definitely have them taken away.
Thanks for the call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Now, in Wisconsin, we don't have a red flag law right now. Amy, could you talk about efforts to bring them into more states? And as Brian was saying, to have a red flag law, stronger ones at the federal level?
Yeah, and this has been really a big push. I mean, when California passed it, there were only two other laws like this in the country, but they were much more limited in scope. And then since the unfortunate number of mass shootings that happened since 2014, we've seen 21 states and Washington, D.C. all pass these laws. And there have been a lot of calls to have a federal red flag law and many other states that have worked on their laws. I know Wisconsin has really put some effort into thinking about putting one together, but hasn't quite, you know, made it happen yet. And in fact, Maine has something that's sort of halfway there, but not quite there. And that has really been called into question after this last shooting. What they did was rather than really going for a red flag law that was specific to somebody who was making threats or exhibiting dangerous behavior that could happen very quickly with very few barriers to take the guns out of the equation, Maine passed what's now being called a yellow flag law because it's tied to their blue paper of psychiatric commitment. So the blue paper is the application to have somebody brought in involuntarily to a mental health hospital. You can also file a yellow paper, hence the name yellow flag law, with that blue paper. But in order to have the firearms removed, you have to have a mental health provider involved that can certify, do an evaluation and certify that the person is dangerous. So, you know, this is problematic if anyone here has ever tried to get an appointment with a mental health provider or get them to do an evaluation. There's a huge shortage across the country, and particularly in Maine. There's not beds, there's not people, there's not, you know, resources to do this. And it just puts this barrier, both a psychological barrier and a temporal one. So if you're a law enforcement officer, rather than just calling a judge on the phone to get the order to remove the firearms, now you have to bring the person in, you have to wait until they can see a mental health practitioner, that person can do an evaluation, more paper gets submitted to the court. It's just a much more arduous process. And you can imagine that it's not going to be quite as effective as something that can happen very quickly in a very serious situation when somebody like this guy is making threats to do something terrible.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Marilyn joins us now in Nina. Marilyn, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Marilyn, or tell us about?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I'm definitely supporting big restrictions. I worked in behavioral health in Wisconsin and firsthand know that if a psychiatrist is feeling somebody's not safe to be discharged, if a judge finds them competent, they can be discharged against medical advice. And we have been, you know, I have known personally in many scary situations, psychiatrist is feeling it's not a good if they where another psychiatrist would have to give the permission instead of a judge that, you know, really is doesn't have that hands-on interpretation of behavioral health. Anyhow, we need much stronger rules and laws, and there's all kinds of areas that need to be tightened up to protect our society, in my personal experience.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. Marilyn cut out a little bit there, but I think we got the gist for the most part. Amy, what do you think about what Marilyn brought up?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Marilyn. And always nice to hear from other healthcare professionals. That same thing has happened to me where I think someone's really dangerous, but it is out of my hands and a judge thinks differently and releases the person. And admittedly, sometimes they release the person, not because they think they're not dangerous, but here in California, your dangerousness has to be due to a mental illness for you to stay in a psychiatric hospital. We're not a perfect solution for everybody who's a threat. We're just a way to treat the people who are posing a threat because they have a mental illness. So if the person is just, you know, wanting to hurt their neighbor who's having an affair with their wife or kill their ex-boss who fired them, that's not due to a mental illness. And so the judge might release that person regardless of how dangerous they are. And this is exactly how I got involved with the crafting of California's red flag law in the first place, was I wanted something that I and law enforcement and others could use as a stopgap measure for those people who do fall through those cracks.
Thanks for that call, Marilyn, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Amy Barnhorst, Vice Chair for Community Mental Health at the University of California, Davis, Department of Psychiatry, talking about gun violence and mental health. Amy, I want to get into some of the other elements of work you are doing, working with healthcare providers on gun violence prevention. What kind of things are you hoping that healthcare providers can do?
Well, one of the things we've found is that healthcare providers really want to be part of the solution to the big public health problem that is gun violence in the United States, but it's not something that's taught in most medical training programs. And many of our patients do rely on us for information about safety and keeping, you know, their household healthy and safe in addition to themselves. But, you know, we're limited by things like time and knowledge and our training. And so the state of California actually passed a bill to fund this program that I run to develop a curriculum to teach mental health care and medical health care providers how to assess patients who are at risk of firearm injury and then intervene with them, usually, you know, hopefully in ways that are voluntary and time limited and collaborative. So, for example, if you are seeing a patient in your family practice clinic and you know, they have a bad breakup, they're drinking more, they're having sort of fleeting thoughts of suicide, but, you know, they're not somebody who merits going to an inpatient psychiatric hospital or something more extreme like that. But this is somebody that might be at risk of, in a time where they're more intoxicated, and if they're a firearm owner, they might be at risk of, you know, making a suicide attempt with their gun. And so having a conversation with them about putting some time and space between them and their firearms in the crisis period, you know, until things have resolved, until some time has passed, is something we teach healthcare providers how to do. So it's not, you know, it's not about getting into people's business about their firearms. It's about really assessing who might be at risk and how can you help them, the way we talk to patients about so many risks about their health and their life. How can we talk to them about their access to firearms or the access to firearms of their, you know, kid who's going through a struggle or their mother-in-law who lives with them and is now having some paranoia due to her dementia, and what can we do to keep the household safe?
And that's for patients who come in to talk to that healthcare provider. Do you have thoughts on ways that, you know, healthcare providers can do public health outreach in the communities to get these messages, even to the people who might not show up in their offices?
Yeah, that's a great question, because so many people don't have good access to healthcare. I think really thinking about this as a public health problem and not about, you know, good and bad, right or wrong, Democrat or Republican, thinking about, you know, firearms are a way of life for many Americans. And one in three or more homes in the U.S. has a firearm in it. And so how do we reach people who do have firearms and just make sure that they're aware of some of the risks and the ways they can mitigate those risks by storing them safely, making sure that people who shouldn't have access to them or people who are in crisis in their household don't have access to them during those times. And kind of treating this like a public health problem, the way we treat things like motor vehicle crashes or cigarette smoking or diet as a public health problem. And physicians aren't, you know, the entirety of the solution here, but I think we can be really important messengers.
As you mentioned, mass shootings like the one in Maine last week are dramatic. They get a lot of attention. They're not the majority of shootings, though. Do you see ways to reach out to other causes of of homicide in particular in this case that aren't the mass shootings that might make the headlines?
Yeah, and really the majority of firearm deaths in the U.S. are suicide. In fact, in Maine in particular, Maine has a very low homicide rate, but their suicide rate is pretty high. 85% of their firearm deaths are suicides in that state. So I think it's really important to have people know that, because in some of the work I've done with firearm owners and shooting instructors and ranges and gun shops, I've learned that most people who are firearm owners take safety very seriously. You know, they're very good about teaching, whether it's their students or their members or their kids, that you have to be really, really careful when you're handling a firearm. But what folks don't seem to talk about as much, and I think this is true, you know, in general, they don't talk about suicide as much. It's a stigmatized topic. It's something that makes people uncomfortable. And people didn't seem to be as aware about the risks of firearms in suicide as they were about the risks of, for example, unintentional injury. I think it's also important to talk about the risks of having a firearm around when you're in some time of interpersonal crisis. You know, I think we all can imagine being driven to the point where we, you know, things got really bad and we wanted to do something terrible. And most of us wouldn't act on that. But sometimes people become really pushed over the edge. They become disinhibited because of drugs or alcohol, or even occasionally, you know, decreased mental capacity. And for those people to have access to a gun during those times, it can really lead to an increased risk of homicide. So just kind of that idea of like, it's not, you know, guns all the time or no guns ever. It's kind of, you know, let's get them away from folks who are in crisis, who are high risk, and work together to make that a collaborative process that is something people can actually talk about and work together on.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Amy Barnhorst, inpatient and emergency psychiatrist, vice chair for community mental health at the UC Davis Department of Psychiatry. Been looking at red flag laws and the intersection between mental health and firearms as the country mourns 18 lives lost in the Lewiston mass shooting that was last week.